I think I'll be able to do too much of an introduction.
Okay, great. So let's get started. Thank you so much, Akiva. Thank you for inviting me. Much appreciated. It's wonderful to see so many friends and familiar faces. My understanding is that Akiva, 45 minutes. That's the length of the show, including question and answer. I forgot what you said, or should I leave time for questions at the end?
Yeah, I guess.
Whatever. Okay, you'll.
Yeah.
All right. I don't know if there's. Well, I'm not even sure like what the group is exactly that I'm talking to, but it looks like a group of really wonderful people. So it's really nice to be able to learn with you, and thank you for staying up late at night to learn together. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk a little bit about how mental health plays a role in halacha. Now that is a very, very broad topic, so we're not going to cover the full breadth of that topic. Meaning, mental health. It means so many different things, and its application to halacha is on so many different levels. Meaning, there's, for example, a concept of a cheresh or a shota in halacha. So that's one particular element of mental health. Then there's certain situations of mental health that just mean like extreme distress or anxiety that might can be considered a chesed chak or might be considered a choli on some level. Meaning, it's never a halacha; it's a factor. In halacha, when it comes to discussing mental health. So I thought it might be easier to do, certainly easier for me, is to go through a number of shailas that I've received over the course of a number of years relating to mental health issues. These were shailas either from therapists or people who are in therapy that relate to all different areas of halacha, but you need to know how to handle the mental health element of each shaila, meaning when a person has certain conditions, whether it be something as common as anxiety, which is which is extremely common, or whether it be something that's much more rare, it's important to know how that might change the halachic outlook for that person. So let me give you a few examples. I'll give you four or five shailas, then maybe we'll discuss one of them. I don't think we're going to be able to discuss four or five, but I'll give you four or five different shailas just to give you a sense of like what's out there. And then maybe we'll discuss one of them. I just want to make one thing clear. I once spoke on this topic or a similar type of topic in a shul in New Jersey, and afterwards someone came over to me, not in that shul, but during the week afterwards, someone came over to me, someone who was not there, told me that they have a friend in the shul who's a therapist who thought what I did was an absolutely terrible thing. How could you tell actual stories of people who are going through things and who are going through therapy? Now no one's going to trust their therapist because they think that, or no one's going to trust their rabbi because they think that the rabbi is just going to get up and talk about it in public in front of everybody. So I just want to be clear. These are shailas that there's no way you could possibly trace back who the people are. The details have not really been changed all that much, but it's either they're so far, they're so short on details that you would never be able to trace who they are, or the people that asked them specifically gave me permission to use them. So one should not think that there is any trust being violated in discussing these questions. So here's question number one. This question came from an ER doctor, and this is not a psychologist, not a psychiatrist, an ER doctor. A baby came into the emergency room, and the baby was unresponsive. So he said, we started working on the child, and after a few minutes of working on the child, it became clear, Rachmana Litzlan, that barring a miracle, we were not going to bring him back. It was over, they were ready to call it. However, there are studies that indicate that parents who lose a child will have better chance at closure if they see the doctors working on the child, meaning they'll feel like at least everything that could be done was done. The parents had not yet arrived at the hospital. The child was brought in by a caretaker. We continued to work on the baby until a few minutes after the parents got there, knowing full well that the child was already gone, and we then pronounced the child dead. Did we do the right thing? Meaning, are we allowed to continue working on what is essentially a dead body in order to allow for an easier, as you know, everything's relative, but an easier recovery, emotional recovery for the parents? That's shaila number one. Shaila number two. None of these shailas are pleasant. None of these shailas are easy. Shaila number two. Someone sent me the following note. text, or I remember, email maybe. Hi Rebbe, hope all is well. Someone wanted me to ask a shayla. A guy is struggling with OCD. So this case, if I recall correctly, the therapist asked me, but he asked because he wanted the patient, the client or patient, I'm not sure, was a Talmud of mine. So he wanted the question asked to me, but the Talmud didn't want to ask it to me directly. So someone wanted me to ask Shaila. A guy is struggling with OCD and anxiety, and one of the therapies is that if you have extreme thoughts, to say them out loud, meaning part of the OCD comes in many different forms. This fellow's OCD was about his way of thinking, that he would think that if he thought something bad, then that bad thing must happen. Or if he makes a deal with himself, if he has a fleeting thought in his head that if you know, when I'm walking on the sidewalk, if I step on the line, then some terrible tragedy is going to happen. You know, then a nuclear weapon is going to be deployed or something like that. So he's convinced that his stepping on the line will actually cause a nuclear weapon to be deployed. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu will make that happen. So one of the ways to deal with it is by getting him used to the idea that not everything he says will actually happen. That there are things that he can say and things that and they're not going to actually happen. So it's what they call exposure therapy. And for exposure therapy, you do it slowly. You first do something that is just out of their comfort zone, and then a little bit further out of the comfort zone, then a little bit further till they get used to the idea of not obsessing over their anxieties. So this guy thinks that if he thinks negatively of somebody, if that person is subsequently hurt, that it's his fault. He once wished ill on somebody, and that person, in fact, really suffered. This happened during his formative years. As a child, he was bullied, and he went home that night, and he thought, and he davened, that the bully should suffer. And the bully was, soon after that, diagnosed with a terrible, terrible illness. And from that moment on, he's convinced himself that he has powers, and that whatever thoughts go into his mind are like a tefillah that the other person should suffer, and therefore the other person will suffer. So the therapy is for him to say out loud that he wants something terrible to happen to somebody. Can he do that, or is that a violation of some sort of halacha? Meaning part of his therapy is to say, pick a random friend and say, I want that person to have cancer. I want that person to die. I want that person to fall off a building. You know, to just say, I want that person to get hit by a car. And say things like that. And then he'll see that none of those things actually happen. Now, it could be that it would backfire, right? Meaning if any of those things actually do happen, so that would be a serious problem. But this is what the therapist recommended: is he allowed to do that if that's what's necessary for his refuah? A third shayla. This one came from a therapist. I'm just giving you an idea of the kinds of questions that are asked, and then we'll pick one to deal with. But a third shayla. From a therapist. Hi, Rabbi Leibowitz, hope all is well. I had a halacha question that came up through my work and was wondering what you thought. I've been working on and off with a young woman who's now in her mid-20s for a number of years. She suffered from very severe depression and suicidality. She has long talked about, but recently disclosed to her family and friends, that she is transgender. Since the disclosure and subsequently starting to take testosterone hormones, her depression has diminished significantly, doesn't report any more suicidal ideation, and describes feeling hope for the future for the first time that she can remember. Today she asked me if I would please write a letter of support that the insurance companies require in order to go ahead with the gender reassignment surgery. I'm wondering what the halachic perspective would be on writing such a letter. So here's a moral dilemma for a frum therapist that's asked to write a letter of support for a person to be able to go through gender reassignment surgery. If it's relevant, the therapist writes, I believe, but I am not certain, that she is a Jewish woman, but not at all affiliated, never was affiliated. That is shayla number three. Shayla number four. I got a phone call once from a guy who I never met. He did not, I believe, if I recall correctly, he did not want to give me his name. He was a man in his early 30s, divorced, and has been trying to date for several years with very little success. And he finally, after years, he finally met somebody that he's really getting along with, that it's really going well with, a divorced woman in her late 20s. And things are going very well. And she recently opened up to him that she was only married for a few months, and during that short marriage, she was abused terribly. And she's been seeing a therapist and knows about herself that she could never trust a man enough to marry him unless she first has the ability to touch him in a non-sexual and non-threatening way so that she can experience nurturing touch, the safety of nurturing touch. And that would mean holding hands, giving hugs, nothing like very heavy. The fellow says she doesn't see any problem with this. She never saw any problem with this. She's much more modern than he is. He comes from a more yeshivish background, and she came from a background where the observance of these halachos was not a major priority in the community that she's from, and she doesn't think it's like such a big deal. To him, it's very shocking that she would even suggest such a thing. So he wants to know if that's the only way that she can get over that mental hump in order to be able to get married, if that's permissible. And then a final mental health question that I pulled out of the files that someone once asked me. A young man suspects that he might be gay. He's not sure. He is certainly feeling stirrings for other men, but he's not sure if he's also attracted to women or if he can develop an attraction to women. He's a very firm boy. He wants to get married. He wants to build a family. His therapist has recommended that he try developing a relationship with a woman where some semi-intimate touching is done. The therapist says it's worked for some people in the past. He's in graduate school now, and he can try dating a non-Jew and being physical with her. So he wants to know whether that's maybe the preferred option, meaning the non-Jew is more likely, he's a frum guy, but a non-Jewish woman is not a nida. A non-Jewish woman is much more likely to have a more casual kind of relationship and be understanding about a casual kind of relationship. So he wants to know if he's allowed to do that, because he certainly doesn't want to experiment on a girl who's in Shiduchim. So that is Shaila number 5. So these are the kinds of questions that Rabbanim get all the time. Certainly, Rabbanim at my level, we get it whenever it comes up, in our communities or in our spheres of influence. But when you're talking about major Rabbanim, you talk about the Rav Herschel Schechters or Mordechai Willigs or David Cohn, the Shmuel Kamenetsky, people of that stature, Rav Asher Weiss, Meisim Bechol Yom. What I just read to you were 5 questions that I got over the course of the last 5 years, or 3 years, or whatever. They got these. It's likely on a given day that they will get all of these questions. So these are the kinds of things that people deal with. Now, none of them are straight mental health questions. I mean, you understand, if we're going to tackle the last question. So what do you have to discuss if we're going to tackle that last question? You have to discuss whether it's permissible for a person to get married if they have no taiva for a woman. You have to discuss whether there's an issue of geneva's das to start developing a relationship that can't go anywhere. You have to discuss how bad is it to develop a relationship with a non-Jewish woman. How bad is it to have a physical relationship with a non-Jewish woman? And then you can get into the mental health side of things and see, based on the level of those Isurim, based on how serious those Isurim are, would the mental health necessity be enough to allow for the violation of those Isurim? The same with the second to last question, when it comes to the nurturing touch, is that called Negiya B'Derech Chiba, or is it not called Negiya B'Derech Chiba? What exactly is the Isur of Negiya B'Derech Chiba? When it comes to the question of the reassignment surgery, what happens when a person goes through a gender reassignment surgery? Do they actually change gender? Or is gender something that's already what you're born with and it stays that way forever? Is that a safek or is that a vadai? How do we even determine gender? What if a person, and it does happen, you think it's only in Mishnayos that there's such a thing called an androgynous. It does happen that there are people that are born in a way that it's unclear whether they're male or female. So do chromosomes determine gender? How do we even determine what a person's gender is? What's the issue of going through the surgery, right? Is writing the letter for the person to be able to go through the surgery, is that a violation of Lifnei Iver? Is that a violation of Misayei Deover Avera and Nisr Midrabanan? Is it pikuach nefesh? That's the mental health element of it. Meaning each of these questions have a significant portion of it that is not really related to mental health. For example, even the second question, working our way backwards, the second question that we ask, the fellow who has thoughts about people, and he thinks that his thoughts are like a miktsas nevuah, and it's going to cause people to die, and it's going to cause people to suffer terribly. So we don't only have to discuss his state of mind, but what about davening for somebody's downfall? Is that okay to daven for somebody's downfall? Is it ever okay to daven for somebody's downfall? What if he chooses someone who deserves it? He chooses someone who's a rasha. So he takes someone who's, let's say, a mass murderer, and he says, I hope that person dies. So is that okay? Are you allowed to daven that person should die? Or let's say he takes someone that one of the poskim that I spoke to said, it named a particular politician who, in this posek's estimation, was absolutely crazy and off the rails, insane, and troubled to the core of their soul. And he said that he should daven that this politician, he mentioned it by name, should be sick, because he already is. He's such a sick man. So you're davening that he should just continue to be what he already is. So that way he won't, So are you allowed to do that? And then you can get into the therapeutic value of this. And also, are you allowed to violate halacha for OCD? And then that's when you get into the mental health side of things. But maybe let's discuss, since I have shiurim online on all of the other topics, I think, already, except for the first one. So maybe we'll get into the first one a little bit. But, again, if you have questions along the way, happy to deal with any of the questions. So how do we tackle this first question? Here you have a situation where this is not from a mental health professional, but every doctor gets some mental health training, right? Because doctors have to deal with people. And when you deal with people, you need to know a little bit of something, especially people in stressful situations. You need to know how to handle people in stressful situations and how to best help them through what is a very difficult and challenging time in their lives. So emergency room doctors are taught that this is the best thing to do, that you continue working on the child, even though the child, as far as if it was any other circumstance, they would have called it, they would have declared him dead, and that would have been the end of it. But because the parents aren't there yet, and they're on their way, and they'll be there in a few minutes, they continue working on the child. Is there any halachic problem with doing so? So there are a number of issues that have to be discussed. I think three issues. Number one is touching a goses, or somebody immediately after death. Is that permissible? Number two is calming a parent who's losing a child, Rachmana Litzlan, is that called pikuach nefesh? Right, the calm that the parent, or the trying to maintain the sanity of the parents. And number three, is that even considered to be a medical treatment, what they're doing to the child? Meaning, it may be a miracle. You know, you've all. Where did I read it? I read somewhere that a woman described. Which book was it? It was a book I was reading recently. A woman described how the gratitude she felt to the doctor that she was in this position. She was in the position that the child was in, and the other doctors had given up on her, and this doctor continued to work on her, and she came back. She recovered. So it's not like crazy. I mean, it's possible. It's possible that it's just at a certain point the doctors give up because it would take a miracle. But it's possible. So is that considered to be a medical treatment that's still ongoing? So let's start with the status of a goses. The general rule is that a goses is someone who's going to die within 3 days. Problem is, you never know if a person is a goses unless you have a time machine, right? Meaning, if you can go ahead 3 days in advance, 3 days ahead, and you say, oh, he's not here anymore, I guess that makes him a goses, and then you go back in your time machine, so that would be great. But, I mean, it's terrible. The whole thing is terrible. But, meaning, that would be an easy way to define whether the person is a goses or not. But how are you going to figure out whether a person is a goses? How are you going to figure out whether he's going to die within the next 3 days? How many times have we had, I mean, I could tell you, how many times have had situations where the doctors have called the family and said, come say goodbye. He's got hours, maybe minutes, to live, come say goodbye, and 6 months later, you sit next to the guy in shul, and he's shuckling away, and playing softball on Sundays, things like that do happen. We don't always know when a person is going to die. Most often that doesn't happen. Most often, the person dies, but sometimes 2 weeks later the person dies, and then you hear at the levay and the hespedim how he was such a fighter and he wouldn't give in, and the doctors. So is that a miracle? It's not a miracle. So we don't have the proper tools of assessment in order to be able to do that. I don't know how many of you heard the interview that a couple of fellows did with Rabbi Ginsburg, Rabbi Chaim Aryeh Zev Ginsburg, where Shlita, whose family was told to come say goodbye before Pesach. He had corona, very, very terrible case of corona, and his kidneys were failing and everything was failing. And Baruch Hashem, now he's running a shul and he's giving drushas every Shabbos and he's doing hour-long interviews and he's speaking at the Aguda convention online this week. So yeah, you have situations like that. We don't always know. So how do you know what a gosis is? So the Rishonim quote from Rabbeinu Meir, that if you left a person becheskas gosis, and then 3 or 4 days pass, then chayiv lis abelalav. You even have to start observing avelos if you're a karov of that person. Derov gosis in lemisa, and we paskin that in Shulchan Aruch. Actually, there's a major discussion in poskim if his wife can get remarried based on that. Meaning, the last time the wife saw the husband, he looked like a gosis. They thought he was a gosis, and now it's a week later, but she hasn't heard anything, right? So can she get remarried? It seems a little quick to get remarried, but can you get remarried based on that chazaka? So, but that's not the definition of a gosis. All that is the simen. All of the Gedolei Olam were mesupuk about the exact geder of a gosis, of exactly how to define what a gosis. So what can't you do to a gosis? So Shulchan Aruch, based on the Rush, says, HaGosis hareu kechai l'chol davar, that he's living, he's a living person. And he goes on to say, Ein tzachin, vein madichin, vein matilin oso alechol, v'lol gabi amelech, ad sho'a sheyamus, vein ma'atzmin es enov, v'anogea bo arezu shofech damim. Whoa! He says, if you have a gosis, don't touch him. You're not allowed to bathe him. You're not allowed to put his body on the sand. You're not allowed to close his eyes. You're not allowed to touch him. And if you touch him, hareza shofech damim. Why is that shofech damim? Why is a person a murderer if they touch a gosis? L'mazeh dome. L'ner ha-metaftef. Kivut shenagabo adam nichpe. If you have a ner, ner means not like we think of as like a wax candle. It's like if you go in the shuk, you see those little klecheres that they have that they would pour oil in and the wick sticks out on one side. So you have a ner that's on its like last bit of oil. So you touch it and it, like the flame is so shvach, the flame is so weak. You touch it and then it goes out. So the ghost is ner Hashem nishmas adam. A person's Hashem is a ner, right? So that's why we always use the mashal of a candle. Of a ner, so if the ner is fading and then you touch it, then it could go out. So you're not allowed to touch a gosis. The Rama adds that even though you can't touch him, if there's something that's monea es misaso, you're not allowed to kill the gosis. So you're not allowed to touch him because it might kill him. But let's say there's something getting in the way of him dying. The guy just wants to die. He would like to die in peace. But the problem is he's in a New York City hospital. And right outside the window of the hospital, there is construction going on in the street, and there are those guys with the jackhammers, right? Those so the poor guy can't die because all he hears is the stupid jackhammers outside. I had a Talmud once in DRS. They were redoing the paving. The sidewalk leading into the yeshiva. So there were these guys ripping up the pavement. So a kid came into shir one day and he said, Rebbe, I just had the most amazing experience. I'm like, why? What happened? He said, I got to use one of those jackhammers. I said, you what? That doesn't seem safe at all. He said, yeah, I was walking by and I saw the guy doing it. I thought it was so cool. So I said, can I try that? And he said, yeah, I couldn't believe it. So he said he got to do it. So that's like a lawsuit waiting to happen. Now that guy is actually, Baruch Hashem, a wonderful Ben Torah, successful attorney, went to Penn Law School. At the time, I thought he was an absolute Meshuggah, for other reasons, not just for that story. But what was I saying? Oh, the guy wants to die, but they're just jackhammering outside. He can't die. So you're allowed to tell the jackhammering guy, tell the construction worker, hang on 5 minutes, just stop 5 minutes, take a lunch break. After this guy dies, you can come back, and then you can go back to your work. You're allowed to do that. That's not called that you're killing negoses. It says, or melech al lishono, if he has salt on his tongue, you're allowed to remove the salt from the tongue. Achronim are bothered by that. Why can you remove the salt from his tongue? Aren't you not allowed to touch him? Aren't you going to be touching him if you remove the salt from the tongue? So the Shach in the Nekudas HaKesef writes, that's a very slight touch, you know, to take the salt off the tongue. But maybe the Rambam is speaking in a case where you can remove it without touching him. So then there's a discussion. What about a non-Jew? Can a non-Jew touch a goses? Meaning, if touching a goses is going to kill him, right? And that, or is a concern that you might kill him. So is that mamish murder? Would we say that, you know, non-Jews are not allowed to commit murder either? Rav Shechter told us that Rav Elchanan Wasserman was unsure whether his wife was a goses at a certain point, and the doctors wanted to give her something to ease her pain. But he wasn't sure if they were allowed to touch her, because she might have been a goses. So Rav Elchanan allowed a non-Jewish doctor to give the medicine. And Rav Shachter told us sort of gifter paskin the same, which is stunning, because if you really hold that it's murder, a non-Jew is not allowed to do it either. But Rav Shachter told us Rav Elchanan and Rav Gifter paskin. Now, Rav Shachter pointed out, it's very difficult to understand. The entire reason not to touch a goses is that it's makarivis misaso, and an akum is also not allowed to murder. So it's very, very difficult to understand, unless you say that the way to define murder is based on how society defines murder. And no one, I mean, for a guy, for a Jew, it's based on the Torah Kedosha. But for a guy, maybe for a non-Jew, maybe it's based on how society would define murder. Maybe that wouldn't be considered murder in a just and fair and ethical society because they're just trying to treat the pain. But maybe the answer is based on the Gemara in Yuma Daf Pehe, that you could be Mechal Shabbos for Chaye Sha'a. And yet the Gemara says that Safik Chai, Safik Meis, Ein Misrapin Me'akum. That if someone is Safik Chai, Safik Meis, you're not allowed to get the refuah from a guy, because the guy will definitely kill him. So better to leave him possibly living. However, Vadai Meis Misrapin Behen. If the guy is for sure going to die, then you can be Misrapin, because if the person is going to die anyway, you have nothing to lose. So the Gemara says, what do you mean you have nothing to lose? You're going to let the guy treat this person. The guy might kill him. Hayiko Chai Shah. Every moment of life is so precious. Every moment of life is so valuable. You're going to lose out on that chayisha, on that moment of life. You know, we believe that. We believe every moment of life is precious. I'll tell you something terrible, a terrible conversation I had recently. I was talking to a friend of mine who is very well connected in many different fields, in business, in medicine, and he told me he was talking to the head of a major Manhattan hospital, to, I don't know if it was the doctor who was running the COVID ward, but of a major Manhattan hospital, and it was a non-Jewish fellow, and the non-Jewish fellow said to this friend of mine, who is a noticeably frum person, he said, I don't understand, my whole life, every time we had someone on a ventilator, every time we had someone, you know, on life support, or I have these religious Jews coming saying, we value every second of life. You cannot pull the plug. You cannot be makarivis misasa. You can't do anything. Every minute of life is so valuable. Every moment of life, there's nothing holier than that. There's nothing. And I buy it. The doctor said, I get it. And that's their value system, and I'm totally okay with that. He said, but if that's true, why is my COVID ward full of only religious Jews? If you value life so much, if every moment of life is so valuable. My friend called me up. He said, what am I supposed to tell someone like that when he asks a question like that? Such a terrible, terrible conversation. But anyway, the Gemara asks a question. Chayisha means something also. Keep a person alive. So how can you say that you have nothing to lose by being Misrape Me'akum? If the person is going to die anyway, he may die sooner by being Misrape Me'akum. And the Gemara says, L'chayisha lo chayshinan. That we're not concerned about Chayisha. What does the Gemara mean? Maybe the Gemara means, when it comes to an Akum, Chayisha is not a value, and therefore it's not murder when Akum is only costing a person what is definitely Chaye Sha'a. Pashas says that's not a good answer, because the Rishonim explain that Chaye Sha'a Lo Chashinan just means that the chance of actually providing a refuah overpowers the downside of losing only Chaye Sha'a, but not that Chaye Sha'a is nothing. Also, there is an issue of, let's leave aside that issue. What about touching a person right after they die, which may be the more relevant issue over here? So Shulchan Aruch says that they would test with a feather to see if a person is breathing, and if the feather doesn't move, they would declare the person to be dead. That's where Moshe Feinstein wrote in his Shuvas. Rav David Feinstein, Zecher Tzaddik Livracha, just passed away recently when he was interviewed by the Halachic Organ Donor Society. You can find it on their website. They have an interview with Rav David Feinstein. So they wanted Rav David to say that brain death is death, as Rav Moshe David Tendler Shlita, our senior Rosh Yeshiva, holds very strongly that brain death is death. Many of our other Rosh Yeshiva, almost all of our other Rosh Yeshiva, strongly disagree with Rabbi Tendler on that particular issue. But this is a major machlokas among Gedolei HaPoskim, well above our pay grade. And Rav David Feinstein never used those words. All he would say is, if cessation of breathing, when the person can no longer breathe, and the person can no longer breathe. That's the definition of death. Where do you get that from? Because Shulchan Aruch says that they would put a feather by the person's nose, and if the feather would move, then the person was alive. If the feather wouldn't move, then the person was dead. We rely on a doctor's determination. So the Beis Lechem Yehuda quotes from a Sefer Hasidim that the mother and father should not kiss their child who's dead, and we shouldn't allow them to kiss the child if they want to. The Torah says Yosef kissed Yaakov after Yaakov dies, but the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh explains that Yaakov Avinu lo meis, so you can't learn anything from what was done to Yaakov. So touching a child after he's dead, even kissing a child right after he dies, is a major problem. Now that's based on Kabbalistic considerations, because Hameis Gadol B'Tumasu V'Tumasu B'Kas V'Ola Adorakia V'Tivka Menefesh HaNoshekes, the Sefer HaChassidim says it has some sort of terrible impact on the nefesh of the one who kisses him, and maybe that's why Yaakov was different. The Geshar Chaim says not to be metaltal ameh shalol tzorich. A person just died, don't move him for no good reason, just to make him more comfortable for the people around. He doesn't provide a source for that, but it might relate to the Isser for a Talmud to be metaltal Talmud Chacham Shlal Tzorech, because a Sefer Torah Shlal Tzorech, rather, because Nishmas Kol Adam is like a Sefer Torah. And the Geshar HaChaim recommends you got to wait 20 minutes after death before touching the body. So going back to our Shiloh over here, if you're not allowed to touch a dead body, and he's really already dead, so then the doctors shouldn't be allowed to touch the body, because, or at the most, he's a koseis, and they shouldn't be allowed to touch the body because they might be killing him. So then the question becomes, is calming a parent considered pikuach nefesh? But even if it is pikuach nefesh, are you allowed to murder for pikuach nefesh? So you have to question, is this really murder? Or is it a last-ditch effort to help beyond what would normally be permissible to do? Maybe it's not murder. It's a chashash that the risk reward is no longer worth it in terms of the chance of a refuah. So you have to really consider if it's usher to do, but it's going to fall short of an isser of murder. So is it considered pikuach nefesh for the parents? Is there emotional anguish considered pikuach nefesh for the parents? You know, I had an opportunity last year, I think it was. I was on a trip during winter vacation with a number of rabbanim, a group of wonderful, wonderful Talmidei Chacham, all good friends of mine. There was a really nice fellow who paid to bring us all to Eretz Yisrael and to spend a week with Rav Asher Weiss. And Rav Asher Weiss took us on a tour of Shari Tzedek's fertility clinic and explained all the halachic issues that come up there. And one of the Rav Asher Weiss is the posik for everybody, right? He's the posik for the Israeli police. He's the posik for the Mossad. He's the posik for Shari Tzedek. He's the posik. So he's the posik for everything. So one of the things that he's a posik for is the branch of the IDF that deals with identifying remains, lo aleinu, rachman al-tzlan, identifying remains of fallen soldiers. So it's a very tricky halachic issue, because a lot of times there's not much left of the body. So DNA, is DNA enough? Is dental records enough? So they were going through all of the halachic issues. Rav Asher Weiss brought us there to go through all the halachic issues. And we asked them to describe some of the halachic shailas that they had. So one of the halachic shailas that they had was that when you have a fallen soldier, they need to inform the parents. Problem is, sometimes the parents aren't in the same neighborhood. Right, so what are you going to do? You have to get in a car to go tell the parents. But it's Shabbos. You just found out the identity of the fallen soldier on Shabbos. Can you get in a car to go tell the parents on Shabbos? Well, the parents will find out after Shabbos. Why do they have to know on Shabbos? Why do they have to ruin the Shabbos? There's a chance that they might find out on Shabbos. Because as soon as anybody in the world knows about it, it's on Twitter, it's on Facebook, it's on, and it can get back to the parents. And if it gets back to the parents in the wrong way, then they're not going to have the support there as the news is being delivered. So the shaila was, can they get in a car to drive to the parents, to inform the parents of a fallen soldier, so they don't find out through social media? Part of Rav Asher's cheshbon was that the pikuach nefesh of the parents, because a parent can have a heart attack with a sudden shock if it's delivered in that way. That is a huge chiddush, that would be considered pikuach nefesh, meaning, but that's the mental health element over here, that just making sure that you have the right setting could even become a situation of pikuach nefesh. There is also a discussion, and this is a much broader discussion than for right now, as to whether it's necessary to treat a patient and prolong his life if his living is a chaye tsar and it's only chaye sha'a. I mean, you could argue what they're doing right now is trying to prolong this patient's life, but they know that they're never really going to fully bring him back, but they're going to keep him breathing manually in this way. So is this something that's worthwhile doing? So that's a further question also. So really this becomes a much more thorny medical halacha issue. I'll tell you, I asked a couple of poskim from our yeshiva about what to do about this issue. Morenu Rav Willig Shlita thought that this is a medical treatment, and we assume that you're always allowed to continue medical treatment. So it's mutter, meaning as long as there's a chance, it's still a medical treatment. It's not a violation of touching a goses. It's not a violation of any of those things. And therefore, if you can also make it better for the parents, then it's a medical treatment that you're making better for the parents. That's perfectly fine to do. Rav Schechter thought differently. Morena Rav Schechter Shlita thought that we normally assume that doctors will know how to touch in a way that's not makariv misasa. I mean, why do we allow doctors to touch a goses? Doctors are always touching a goses. They're always handling them and treating them because we assume that doctors, we don't know how to touch. We might move the person, try to turn them over and kill them by accident. But a doctor has experience with these things and they know what helps and what hurts. And therefore, the doctor, we assume, is not going to be makariv misasa. But says Rav Schechter, that's only when they're treating or touching based on medical protocols that are in the best interest of the patient. But if all medical protocols tell you that this is not within the best interest of the patient, and you're doing it for somebody else, for the parents, they know that the patient has no chance, they're just doing it for the parents, then the doctor would be like anybody else who's not allowed to touch a goses or someone who is just recently deceased. Rav Schechter thought in that case, certainly the frum doctor in the group should step back, even if the others are going to continue to work on the patient. So again, these are just some of the issues that come up when it comes to taking into account mental health. It's the trickiest part about mental health is figuring out when it's pikuach nefesh and when it's not. You know, even suffix pikuach nefesh is pikuach nefesh, but it's not always easy to identify suffix pikuach nefesh. You know, sometimes people say, oh, the person's just a little sad, you know, but they don't realize that he's not just a little sad. He's suffering from clinical depression and he could be having suicidal thoughts. And, you know, and it's not easy to spot when these things rise to the level of pikuach nefesh. And that's why it's very important that the poskim that deal with mental health issues be poskim who have a lot of experience in dealing with those kinds of issues and who understand the field and who are willing to talk to the professionals to understand the implications of the shailas that they're dealing with. You know, people like all of the poskim that we mentioned earlier, the great Gedolei HaPoskim who deal with this on a regular basis, have a certain sensitivity in terms of knowing how to deal with these issues. So we'll stop there and maybe we'll leave a few minutes for questions, if anybody has any questions. No questions? Okay.
I have a question.
Yeah?
So, on a methodological level, it sounds like mental health is more of the last factor. Like, once you go through everything, is that how you should be framing it? As in, once we have all the other factors, now we answer the mental health factor?
It's important to know what the halacha would be absent the mental health factor, because mental health normally it's going to determine how big of a shasad chak. If it's going to be pikuach nefesh, it's going to be docha almost everything. But if you've determined that something is murder, then even pikuach nefesh is not going to be docha murder. So I think it's important to think about what the halacha would be absent the mental health factor, Because a lot of times it makes the shaila go away, meaning the whole shaila becomes a non-shaila. Let's say the case of the fellow who thinks bad things are going to happen. Is there an iser to think bad things are going to happen? If I can come to the determination that there's nothing usser about thinking that bad things are going to happen, so then I don't even need to get into how big of a shas hadchak it is for the person. Or let's say you have a person who has OCD that repeats brachos and shmona esrei 18 times. Right, so the therapy is you're never ever allowed to repeat a bracha in Shmoneh Esrei. I don't care how little kavanah you had, I don't care what. Right, that's what you tell the person. You just have to go straight through. How bad is it to not repeat when you had no kavanah? Right, let's say the person had no issues. So I think methodologically it is valuable and probably correct to first think about what the halacha would be, and then say, okay, now that I have this shasat chak, or pikuach nefesh, you know, determined based on the mental health professionals. Now, how does that impact? How does that impact the shaila?
I think
okay, Morty, you're on mute. Are you raising your hand?
Yeah. Sorry. Can Rabbi hear me?
Yes.
Can Rabbi direct us to maybe other stream where Rabbi addresses the other questions?
Oh, they're all online. They're all. If you search on YU Torah, the word desk. From the Rabbi's Desk. I've been giving a series of shiurim called From the Rabbi's Desk for a number of years already. So there are probably a couple of hundred of them. So if you scroll through them, you'll find the rest of those, among other interesting shailas, I think. Okay. Very good. Okay. Good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for coming to learn with me this evening.
Thank you.